And you are listening to Radio Free America. This is our Radio Free America broadcast, number 33, part 5 of the Iran-Contra stuff. And tonight we're dealing with mysterious deaths and break-ins. And we've still got one more broadcast coming up. And just for those of you just tuning in who have missed the first part of the broadcast or have never heard this broadcast before, we might want to mention to you these are archive broadcasts. They are, unlike our regular Sunday show, they tend to be one topic, rather dense in information, and no phones. We don't answer phone calls. So they sometimes make difficult listening, and we appreciate that, and that's why we advocate that people tape. And we will mention later in the broadcast, again, the address and phone number of the tape duplication service that makes these tapes available if you cannot do your taping at home.
Alrighty. Now, basically, what we've been looking at concerns the mysterious death of people connected in various ways with these investigations. We took a look at, we're beginning, I should say, by taking a look at people, either investigators or participants in the Contra drug traffic, that is to say, the primarily cocaine traffic, but also marijuana traffic that was being used to finance the Contra supply effort. Now, one of the aspects of the Contra supply effort that we've been focusing on primarily concerns the interrelationship between the Medellin cartel, M-E-D-E-L-L-I-N, and the Contra supply effort. And one of the people connected with the Contra supply effort, and specifically the drug-running aspect of it, was a man named George Morales. George Morales was, among other things, a championship speedboat racer who subpoenaed, among others, George Shultz, the Secretary of State, and George Bush, the Vice President, as witnesses in his trial. We took a look at Morales in considerable length in Radio Free America number 29. Now, a fellow who also had connections to George Bush and who may have been connected in some way to the drug traffic, was assassinated under strange circumstances. His killing is as yet unsolved. His name was Donald Aronow, and interestingly enough, many people who have been looking into the Donald Aronow killing have compared it with the death of Adler Barry Seal, a person we dwelt on at great length in Radio Free America 29. We're going to be coming back to him in just a second. Barry Seal also was assassinated, and he also appears to have had a lot to say with regard to the Medellin cartel and its relationship to the Contra supply effort.
Also, as we mentioned before, the just about everywhere you turn are the wingtip footprints of George Bush, as we will see again in this next article from the New York Times for Thursday, February 5th, 1987. The headline, Miami Death Likened to Drug Slaying. The article is by George Volsky, a special to the New York Times, Dateline Miami. A federal official today described the killing Tuesday of Donald Aronow, A-R-O-N-O-W, a noted Miami boat builder and businessman, as a, quote, typical hit carried out by, quote, Colombian drug traffickers. The official, Billy Yout, a spokesman for the Miami Office of the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, said that in 90% of the investigations of similar killings, Colombian drug dealers were found to be involved. Commander William P. Johnson, a spokesman for the Metro Dade County Police Department, which is in charge of the investigation, said, quote, Mr. Aronow was involved in many diverse activities here, and we are looking into all of them to find a possible motive, unquote. The 59-year-old Mr. Aronow was shot at 4 p.m. yesterday in the northeast section of Miami, where there are many boatyards and marinas. He was shot several times from a dark blue late-model Lincoln Town Car. The shots were directed at Mr. Aronow's white Mercedes-Benz Roadster. According to witnesses, the Lincoln was parked near an office of a friend whom Mr. Aronow visited. When he drove away, witnesses said the dark car pulled alongside the Aronow auto, and after both stopped at an intersection, one or more occupants of the dark car fired at Mr. Aronow. The dark car sped away. Because its windows were tinted, witnesses did not see how many people were inside. Late today, the police released a composite picture of the presumed assailant. The man was described as having, quote, tan complexion, as 30 to 40 years old, with several days' growth of beard. Mr. Yout of the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency said there was a similar murder last year in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in which a government informer, Barry Seal, was killed. And as Dave mentioned, we'll get to that in just a moment. Quote, but the similarity stops there, he said. I have checked our records, and we have nothing on Mr. Aronow there. Mr. Yout said that the agency was willing to assist the county police if asked. Skipping down in the article, Mr. Aronow was best known for his design of a speedboat called the Cigarette, now notorious for its frequent use by drug smugglers to transfer drugs from motherships into the many unwatched spots on the South Florida coast. In the last several years, law agencies have also began using speedboats of the Cigarette type, some of which can go 80 miles an hour. Since 1985, the Customs Service has bought 13 of the boats from Mr. Aronow. Mr. Aronow also became a friend of Vice President Bush, who owns a 28-foot cigarette built for him by the cigarette racing team of North Miami Beach. Anna T. Barnett, the executive assistant United States attorney in Miami, was quoted in the Miami News today as saying that Mr. Aronow had a, quote, close working relationship with the Customs Service, unquote. She added, quote, of course he made a lot of money from his contacts with the service. Now, a couple of things, obviously interesting. We talked at great length in the past when George Bush started to head up the Federal Drug Task Force in the Miami area. We talked about how reminiscent, considering George Bush's own background with the CIA, how reminiscent this was of the Nixon administration's so-called big drug push to destroy the heroin market, which in fact only transferred the heroin market to political friends and allies of Richard Nixon. Also, no less an authority on dirty dealings than Frank Turple, former intimate of Edwin Wilson, himself currently a federal fugitive, said, well, basically the whole thing with George Bush and the drug task force is it's their excuse to use the DEA as a, basically, to paraphrase him, as a hypodermic to inject the CIA directly into a lot of other Central American affairs and Caribbean affairs that they weren't involved in already. Interestingly enough, Donald Aronow, not only was a friend of George Bush's, killed in a drug-type hit, but was also working with the Customs Service, and his boats were used extensively for drug smuggling. As we've talked at great length, the Miami drug smuggling industry is perilously close to being, in fact, part of the Miami right-wing political intrigue division of the CIA.
Now, George Morales, remember, one of the Contra drug traffickers, or one of the people trafficking on behalf of the Contra supply effort, was indeed a championship powerboat racer. So the powerboat connection here is one to think about. Now, the people who were being interviewed in that article described the killing of Donald Aronow as being similar to that of Adler Berry Seal. Now, again, we dwelt at considerable length with Adler on Adler Berry Seal in RFA number 29, the first program in our Iran-Contragate series. We're going to review something about Berry Seal's situation right now. He also appears to have been someone who may have been gotten rid of in order to prevent the Contra drug supply connections from coming out, because Adler Berry Seal had been used as a stingman against the Medellin cartel. As it turns out, his charges of Sandinista drug trafficking appear to lead rather in the opposite direction, and as we'll see, the people responsible for drumming up, as it appears they did, the story about Sandinista involvement in the cocaine trafficking, all in turn appear to have links not only to the Medellin cartel, but specifically to the Contra supply effort and the whole reactionary Miami milieu associated with it. Reading from an article in Mother Jones, specifically from Mother Jones' issue of April of 1987, this is an article called Dead Men Tell No Tales, and it's authored by Joel Millman, who was a lawyer who's been looking into a lot of these different aspects. Again, Dead Men Tell No Tales, subheaded, Some Contragate Players Will Never Get to Testify. Joel Millman in Mother Jones' issue of April 1987. And Millman writes about Adler Berry Seal. Berry Seal, the narco-terrorism connection. Drugs also figure prominently in the case of Adler Berryman Berry Seal, a Louisiana pilot murdered in Baton Rouge on February 19, 1986. Seal's death left the Reagan administration without its key witness in efforts to prove that top Sandinista officials are engaged in narco-terrorism, unquote, the hybrid of drug trafficking and Marxist revolution. Seal, a dope smuggler and former TWA pilot, was the man who first linked the Sandinistas to cocaine and took the grainy black-and-white photographs that President Reagan showed to a nationwide TV audience in March of 1986 to prove, unquote, Sandinista involvement. Berry Seal entered the Contra War in 1984 after a Miami conviction on narcotics trafficking left him facing the possibility of spending the next 10 years in federal prison. Seal tried to strike a deal to avoid serving time, but three attempts to turn over, unquote, and work as an undercover informant for officials in Florida and Louisiana were rebuffed. Yet, under the direction of Vice President Bush's newly formed National Narcotics Border Interdiction System, Seal was turned back over to the DEA in Florida to begin working on the Sandinista drug sting. Quote, at first we had trouble with his credibility. We just didn't believe what he said he could do, said Richard Gregory of the Federal Task Force assigned to supervise Seal, quote, but then he did it, unquote. It was the much-ballyhooed Sandinista cocaine connection, which Seal said he stumbled on in May of 1984 while flying drugs between Miami, Panama, the Bahamas, and Colombia, all the while relaying his findings to federal agents. As Justice Department officials readily acknowledge, Seal was the key informant on the Sandinista connection. To this day, high-level DEA officials in Washington refuse to characterize Nicaragua as an important link in the Colombia-United States drug chain, arguing that no conclusive intelligence has emerged to buttress Seal's claims. Seal later testified in a Miami courtroom that Nicaragua was on the verge of becoming a most important way station on the Pony Express-like system of pilots flying raw coca paste north from South America for its eventual delivery as processed cocaine in the United States. According to Seal, Managua was not only a refueling point, but, with the knowledge of Sandinista officials, also the future site of a major cocaine laboratory. No federal law enforcement agency has been able to corroborate Seal's testimony. Seal's version of finding the Sandinista connection amounts to an extraordinary game of connect the dots, with each dot representing an incident, from the crash of one plane in Colombia to a second plane being shot down in Nicaragua to yet a third plane returning to Managua for which Seal was the only living U.S. witness. The dots lead Seal, he said, to the Managua airstrip where, with a hidden camera, he took the now famous photos of drugs allegedly being loaded onto his C-123 plane. But the game ended when the White House leaked details of Seal's mission to the Washington Times, even as the sting was continuing. The stories that appeared in July of 1984 did not identify Seal by name, but they effectively exposed him as a government informant to his drug contacts, who, DEA officials say, rubbed him out in Baton Rouge. The Times story also cost the government a chance at the time to prosecute the leaders of the Colombian cocaine mafia, who DEA officials had hoped to apprehend with Seal's help. Contra critic Jack Terrell says Seal's mission may also have involved shipping weapons and drugs to the Contras or carrying out intelligence recognizance, all under the direction of the White House. 8 months after Seal's death, when William Cooper, Buzz Sawyer, and Eugene Hassenfuss were shot out of the sky while running guns to the Contras, they were flying the same C-123 plane Seal had used in his drug sting. Cooper and Sawyer died in the crash, but Hassenfuss later identified a man linked to Vice President Bush, who ran the Contra arms supply network out of Ilopango Airport in El Salvador. According to Seal's family and friends, he had often boasted of a close relationship with Bush's staff. And reporter John Camp of WBRZ-TV in Baton Rouge says Seal had discussed with him the possibility of filming a weapons drop in Central America in January of 1985. He said it might make a good story down the road, says Camp. The shipment, presumably arms, would go to a military base in El Salvador or Honduras, I don't recall which, and Seal said he had State Department permission, unquote. While Seal's story of the Sandinista drug connection may seem like pulp fiction, some of the details of his operation are not. His statements about cargo drops, the purchase of planes, and the laundering of plane registrations have been echoed by subsequent stories of the White House's private aid network. Well, we looked again at Seal at considerable length in RFA 29. The key aspects of the Seal situation are that the alleged Sandinista official photograph, Federico Vaughn, has never been positively identified as an official of the Sandinista government. His cousin, or a very close relative, it might actually be his uncle, but I believe it's his cousin, Barney Vaughn, has indeed been identified as a pro-Contra banker. His brother, or his cousin rather, has very close connections to the Contra supply effort. Now, the weapon used to kill Adler Barry Seal came from the gun shop of a man named Jose Coutin, C-O-U-T-I-N, who was also part of the Contra supply network. And a man named Jesus Garcia described the entire Contra supply effort, of which he and Barney Vaughn and Jose Coutin were part, as, quote, George Bush's baby, unquote. So the situation vis-a-vis Barry Seal appears that not only did he not sting the Sandinistas, but that in attempting to frame the Sandinistas and by attempting to portray them as a way station for the Medellin cartel, he was doing two things inadvertently. He was betraying the Medellin cartel and the very Contra supply network of which he was part. He also was signing his own death warrant, because what is not mentioned in this article is that the federal government had removed its protection from Barry Seal, himself a federal witness, shortly before before he was machine gunned with a weapon from Contra supporter Jose Coutin's gun shop.
One of the things, one of the points the article made that also needs to be emphasized is that with the death of Adler Barry Seal, not only was he not around to explain his role in this whole Sandinista scam trying to pin the drug trade on the Sandinistas, in fact, the attempt being made by the very self same people who are dealing cocaine for the Reagan administration, but he was then no longer around to testify against the Medellin cartel. And as we're going to see, in fact, the Medellin cartel appears to be so closely linked to the Contra efforts that the suggestion that, in fact, the administration wanted to prosecute the Medellin cartel may be itself merely another bit of political propaganda, and they may have been just as glad to see Barry Seal gone, not only for his Sandinista story, but because of the possible dent he might put in Medellin.
Now, one of the speculative aspects concerning the Contra supply effort and its drug connections that we dealt with in Radio Free America number 29 concerned a possible link-up between the Contra supply effort and the so-called pizza connection case in New York City. Actually, as we'll talk about in a second, there are two pizza connection cases, and one of the things that we raised as food for thought and grounds for further research is what relationship, if any, exists between the two pizza connection cases, because they're very similar, they appear to be related, and one of them, at least, is directly connected to the Medellin cartel. Now, what we're going to be looking at here concerns the shooting death and attempted murder of two witnesses in what we're going to call Pizza Connection 1. Now, Pizza Connection 1 concerned a mafia heroin distribution ring which distributed its heroin from pizzerias primarily in the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest and Midwest. Now, the key aspect of this for our purposes here is that the proceeds from this heroin distribution scam were laundered through two major brokerage houses. One of those was Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner and Smith. The head of Merrill Lynch at the time was Donald Regan, up until earlier this year, White House Chief of Staff for many, many years. The other major brokerage house through which the Pizza Connection 1's proceeds were laundered was E.F. Hutton. The head of E.F. Hutton at the time was Scott Pierce, who was George Bush's brother-in-law. As the Iran-Contra case was breaking, the Pizza Connection case was coming to trial. Two key figures in that investigation were shot, one of them fatally, one of them near fatally. And the reason that we're asking about a possible connection between this pizza connection and Contra supply effort is that shortly after this case, another pizza connection case, a mafia drug distribution case, emerged in Washington, D.C. This also used pizza chains to distribute the drugs, and while there was some heroin distributed for Pizza Connection 2, the Washington, D.C. case, the main drug being distributed was cocaine from, you guessed it, the Medellin cartel. Some of the same organized crime families appear to have been involved, and we're basically going to take a look at the murder and attempted murder in Pizza Connection 1 and ask whether the fact that they occurred as the case was coming to trial and as Iran-Contra gate was breaking may perhaps indicate that Pizza Connection 1 and Pizza Connection 2 are one and the same.
The article we're going to read next is from the New York Times for Thursday, December 4th, 1986. The headline, Police Pursuing Idea for Motive in Pizza Slaying, and the article is written by Todd S. Purdom. Detectives investigating the murder of a defendant in the Pizza Connection drug trial are leaning toward the theory that he was killed because he was preparing to cooperate with prosecutors, law enforcement officials said yesterday. The body of the defendant, Gaetano Mazzara, M-A-Z-Z-A-R-A, who was accused of being a heroin supplier and member of the Sicilian Mafia, was found in a garbage bag on a Brooklyn street Tuesday, 5 days after his family had reported him missing. Mr. Mazzara, a 51-year-old former restaurant owner from Sayreville, New Jersey, had been on trial in federal district court in Manhattan along with 19 other defendants accused of operating a major ring that distributed drugs and money and hid its operations behind a network of pizza restaurants. The police initially reported that Mr. Mazzara had sharp gashes in the back of his head and above his right eye that might have been made with an axe or cleaver. Yesterday, they said preliminary autopsy results had also found two .22-caliber slugs in the victim's head, but that the precise cause of death had not been determined. Parenthetically, I might put in, it doesn't really matter, because the guy was pretty obviously thoroughly killed. Skipping down, law enforcement officials, meanwhile, said Mr. Mazzara, who was last seen at a bakery in Sayreville the day before Thanksgiving, may have known an Italian national who was found shot to death in a car in Broad Channel, Queens, last Saturday night. The official said the victim in that case, Francesco Caruso, age 39, was a courier who transported drugs between the United States and Europe. They said there was no indication that the murders were linked, but said it was possible the two men had moved in the same circles.
Now, again, this murder took place just as Iran-Contra Gate was beginning to break in a big way. The Pizza Connection case was just coming to trial at the time. Interestingly enough, another key figure in the case was shot and wounded shortly thereafterward. Reading from the San Jose Mercury News of February 12th of 1987, it's an AP story out of New York, headlined, "Gunmen Shoot Defendant in Organized Crime Trial." A pair of gunmen shot and wounded two men, one a defendant in the Pizza Connection organized crime trial and the other a bystander, on a busy Manhattan street Wednesday in what police called a hit. The gunman opened fire in front of the Black Rock Cafe in Greenwich Village about 5 p.m. and ran from the scene, with one jumping into a waiting van and the other into a waiting cab, said Chief of Detectives Robert Colangelo. It was the second recent attack on defendants in the trial. Another defendant was found slain in a garbage bag in an industrial section of Brooklyn in December with $700 cash still in his pockets. Both victims were taken to St. Vincent's Hospital, where the trial defendant, Pietro Alfano, 46, was listed in critical condition with three gunshot wounds in the back, said Alice McGillian, Deputy Police Commissioner for Information. Skipping down on the article, the Pizza Connection trial in Manhattan Federal Court has been so dubbed because the defendants allegedly used pizza parlors in the Midwest and Northeast as fronts to market more than $1 billion in drugs over 10 years. So again, the question we're asking is, perhaps was the pressure being brought to bear on the Pizza Connection case perhaps due to Pizza Connection 2, which emerged in Washington, D.C.? Interestingly enough, just as Pizza Connection 2 was about to break, well, actually, Pizza Connection 2 broke in the February 3rd, 1987 Washington Post. About a little over a week later, Scott Pierce resigned completely from E.F. Hutton. And Scott Pierce, of course, had been head of that organization. He had been demoted. He was no longer head, but he resigned from E.F. Hutton about 2 weeks later. About 2 weeks after that, Donald Regan, the head of the other major brokerage house featuring in the laundering of Pizza Connection 1's money, resigned or was replaced as White House Chief of Staff. And again, the question we're asking is what relationship there might be between those. As we took a look in another case, E.F. Hutton was represented by Attorney General Griffin Bell, the former Attorney General under Jimmy Carter. Interestingly enough, Jimmy Bell was the attorney for Eugene Hasenfuss and went down to rescue him when Hasenfuss was shot down in Nicaragua. So again, one of the questions we're asking is, given the fact that Pizza Connection 2 was definitely distributing Medellin cartel cocaine, we're wondering if the two are related, and in turn, whether perhaps some of the, not only some of the people being shot in connection with the Pizza Connection case, but as we're going to see, pressure being brought to bear on the jury and on some of the key witnesses, whether that had anything to do with the Iran-Contra scandal. Many of the deaths that we're going to be looking at here do occur in a speculative context, but given the many, many bases touched by the Iran-Contra secret team, it's worth asking these questions.
We're going to read about the death of a very well-known figure. The article, the obituary, as a matter of fact, is from the San Francisco Chronicle for Thursday, March 19th, 1987. It's a UPI obituary, and the person that they're talking about is the late great, if you stretch the meaning of the word great, Santo Traficante, Traficante. The obituary is Dateline, Tampa, Florida. Santo Traficante Jr., the reputed head of organized crime in Florida since the early 1950s, died on Tuesday at the Texas Heart Institute in Houston. Traficante, age 72, had been in failing health for several years and was at the hospital for heart bypass surgery when he died. He was rated number 15 last October in a Fortune magazine list of the 50 most powerful organized crime figures in the United States. Most of his income was said to come from gambling, loan sharking, and narcotics activities. He reportedly assumed the role of mob boss in Florida when his father, Santo Sr., died of cancer in August 1954. Traficante, who was born November 4, 1915 in Tampa, was consistently named by government investigators as a charter member of the Mafia ever since the Senate's Kefauver Committee hearings in Tampa in 1950. In October 1970, Traficante pleaded guilty to an obstruction of justice charge and was given a one-year suspended sentence for a misdemeanor, the first conviction against him that stuck. He had been arrested in the past for bribery, lottery, and investigation for homicide, but nothing was ever proven. A prior conviction, on a charge of bribing a St. Petersburg vice officer, was reversed by the U.S. Supreme Court. In September 1978, Traficante told a House committee that he participated in a CIA assassination plot against Cuban President Fidel Castro because, quote, "I thought I was helping the United States government," unquote. He was also a witness in 1977 before the House committee investigating the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, but he refused to answer questions. In July 1979, the House panel concluded in its final report that Traficante and the reputed mafia boss in New Orleans, Carlos Marcello, were, quote, "the most likely family bosses of organized crime to have played a role in the Kennedy assassination." Now, one of the things, now, Santo Traficante, first, obviously, yes, he was an old man. Yes, he was an old man who had heart trouble. However, he did die at an opportune time just to make sure that he himself was not going to be around to testify, nor could the threat of putting him on trial be used against anybody in his family. Santo Traficante, however, has a long and checkered career that winds in and out of the tail of the CIA and the American intelligence and security establishment's operations down in Florida and in the South in general. Miami, of course, has been practically the headquarters for illicit intelligence activity for a long, long time. Traficante, of course, is mostly important for our purposes, well, as mentioned, because of his connections to the Kennedy assassination and through that to the secret team, quote-unquote, and also because of his role in the drug traffic, which is, as we've mentioned several times, is a very important part of the story that we're telling here.
Now, one of the things that we looked at during our five-part Radio Free America series about the involvement of the intelligence community in the narcotics traffic concerns something that Niptuck referred to earlier, namely the use of the DEA not to prevent drugs from coming into the country, but to determine who is going to profit from those drugs, basically a regulatory agency rather than an enforcement agency to see to it that the drugs don't get into the country. One of the things we looked at was something that author Henrik Kruger termed the Great Heroin Coup. Now, what the Great Heroin Coup was the elimination of the French Union Chorus, the Corsican syndicate that had dominated the international heroin trade, to the betterment of American mafia elements, specifically the Southern Rim Mafia, closely associated with the Nixon White House, and also Santos Traficante Jr. Now, the three key figures involved in this, according to Henrik Kruger, were Santos Traficante Jr., a man named Lucien Conin, a former U.S. intelligence agent, actually apparently a current U.S. intelligence agent, and a prime mover in the U.S. national security establishment after World War II, a man named General Edward Lansdale. Basically, those three individuals were responsible for channeling the Golden Triangle heroin to the Cuban Florida Mafia. Now, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 29 and in Radio Free America number 31, this Cuban Mafia was very, very closely associated with the milieu that was basic. Well, actually, that was in Radio Free America number 30, I guess that was, where we took a look at the CIA-sponsored Cuban terrorist organizations and their relationship with the mafia organization of Santos Traficante Jr. We dealt with that at considerable length in Radio Free America's 26 and 27. We then came back to it in numbers 29 and 30. So those are the Radio Free America reference points. It's too complicated a connection to go into right now. Suffice it to say that some of the terrorist incidents of the mid-1970s, such as the bombing of an Air Cubana plane, the assassination of Orlando Letelier, and many other crimes, came back to the Peru-associated anti-Castro Cubans associated with CIA and with the mafia organization of Santos Traficante Jr. Incidentally, we also took a look at the company, quote-unquote, an arms for drug smuggling ring, which has connections not only to the U.S. national security establishment, but also to the assassination of John Kennedy and organized crime figures grouped in and around Santos Traficante Jr. And again, Traficante was referred to by the Christic Institute as part of one of the builders of the shooter's team, unquote, during the Operation 40 and Operation Mongoose, the U.S. guerrilla warfare campaigns against Fidel Castro in the early and mid-1960s. Now, in addition to Santos Traficante, who dropped dead, although granted he was an old man, right in the middle of the Iran-Contra hearing, we have questions about a death of one of the other, an elderly member of that same triumvirate, because General Edward Lansdale died at just about exactly the same time. Nip, what was the date on the Traficante, the specific date on Traficante's obit?
March 19th, 1997,
March 19th?
Yeah.
Okay. Traficante died on March 19th. February 24th, less than a month earlier, General Edward Lansdale died. AP story, Dateline Washington, from the San Francisco Chronicle, Tuesday, February 24th of 1987. Research credit on this article goes to Mae Brussel, and the article is headlined, General Lansdale Dies, Covert War Expert. Retired Air Force Major General Edward G. Lansdale, 79, a pioneer counterinsurgency expert and close advisor to leaders of the Philippines and South Vietnam, died yesterday. His exploits as a covert action specialist brought Lansdale attention to the point that he became the inspiration for two novels, The Quiet American by Graham Greene and The Ugly American by Eugene Burdick and William J. Lederer. Lansdale pioneered the concepts of military civic action programs and psychological operations to undermine popular support of the leftist Huk Rebellion in the Philippines during the 1950s. Serving as military advisor to Defense Minister Ramon Magsaysay, Lansdale emphasized that insurgency had to be fought with a four-point strategy focusing on social, political, economic, and military factors. He was said to have told Magsaysay about the broader context of the Huk insurgency. Quote, "If I had to live in such conditions, I would be a communist too," unquote. Lansdale continued to be Magsaysay's mentor after the latter's election to the presidency of the Philippines in 1953. When Magsaysay implemented Lansdale's program, the Huk insurgency withered with relatively little bloodshed. In South Vietnam, Lansdale urged a similar multi-pronged approach, which he believed, quote, would take the cause away from the guerrillas. Help from Lansdale and the CIA was a key factor in the rise to power of South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem. Lansdale served as chief of CIA covert operations in Indochina, and I would add thereby inevitably, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 24, becoming deeply involved in the covert operations side of narcotics trafficking. Skipping down in this article, in the early 1960s, Lansdale headed Operation Mongoose, an abortive White House scheme aimed at getting rid of Cuban President Fidel Castro. Now, one of the interesting things about that is that, of course, Operation 40 and Operation Mongoose bring General Lansdale right back to the same secret team milieu that the Christic Institute is focusing on, and indeed, Santos Traficante was part of that same team. The two men died within less than a month of each other. Both men were old, but were wondering whether their deaths coming, I could also look at the fact they managed to live a long time until this scandal broke, were wondering if there's any relationship between their deaths, the Iran-Contra scandal, which broke a couple of months before. Both men were eye-deep, really, in this same drug trafficking intelligence milieu we've been focusing on. We're wondering if the two men's deaths are related to each other and, in turn, to the Iran-Contra scandal.
Indeed, and the beat goes on. We're going to read another, about a couple of more interesting deaths from an article we quoted from earlier in the broadcast, that article being Dead Men Tell No Tales by Joel Millman from Mother Jones, issue of April 1987. Right now, we're going to read about Major Ricardo Zuniga. Ricardo Zuniga was a Honduran officer, and of course the place of Honduras in this whole thing cannot be underestimated, although it doesn't get talked about much. But the presence of the Contras and the pressure put on Honduras to house the Contras and let the Contras use Honduras as a base has wreaked some serious havoc in Honduran society, as it has on the other side of Nicaragua in Costa Rica, which used to be a model democracy, which has suffered a great deal politically since the Reagan administration took over and began using them as a staging ground also. Anyway, we're going to read about Major Ricardo Zuniga, and the subheading for this section of Dead Men Tell No Tales is Honduras Under a Foreign Power. Despite the congressional revelations of U.S. military involvement in the Tapascali attack is where two of the civilian material assistance men, the supposed civilian volunteer forces, in fact probably mercenary forces, who joined up with the Contras, but that's Tapascali. Despite the congressional revelations of U.S. military involvement in the Tapascali attack, the Republican Senate and Democratic House lacked the consensus on Central America to probe further. Quote, "We were aware that they used U.S.-built airstrips and that the planes came from the CIA," remembers a staffer from the Senate Appropriations Committee. "But after a certain point, it all has to go to the intelligence committees, and there things have a tendency to disappear." A year later, a former Honduran Army major, a source in the intelligence committee's inquiries into Contra aid, himself disappeared. After 2 weeks, the battered and partially decomposed body of Ricardo Zuniga Morazan was discovered near Honduras's Nicaraguan border. Zuniga's murder has yet to be solved, and he is viewed as a martyr by many Hondurans who believe his killing was a result of information he provided to staffers from the House Intelligence Committee and other congressional committees in 1984 and 1985. Under almost any other U.S. administration, Ricardo Zuniga would have been the toast of the White House. A career military man and the son of a rich Honduran landowner, he spoke impeccable English, married an American woman, and was among that class of Latin machos who have long served as Washington surrogates in the hemisphere. In addition to two training sessions with the U.S. Army at Fort Benning, during one of which, in 1969, he lost a chance for a taste of combat in his country's brief soccer war with El Salvador, he served in the Honduran embassy in Washington. His only defect, from the point of view of the Reagan administration, was his idealism. By 1982, Zuniga was serving as a liaison between the Honduran army and U.S. military leaders at the U.S. embassy in Tegucigalpa. While he opposed both the Sandinistas and the Somoza regime they replaced in Nicaragua, Zuniga questioned the effectiveness of the Contras and opposed the changes within Honduras brought on by the United States Contra policy. That policy, friends remember Zuniga saying, was turning his country, quote, into a whorehouse. He came to Washington in 1984, says one House staffer who met with him, as part of a mission to, quote, get the Contras to do what they said they would do, which was to get into Nicaragua and fight instead of hanging around Tegucigalpa trying to intimidate the Honduran army because they had the backing of the United States. A lobbyist named Bruce Cameron made the rounds of Congress with Major Zuniga, who represented a group of more than 20 young, quote, reform officers in the Honduran military, looking to break the U.S. Embassy's grip on their country's political life. Zuniga's visits began in spring of 1984, and his testimony was hair-raising. He told congressional staffers about a special security unit, the 316 Battalion, set up by Honduran strongman General Gustavo Alvarez. The battalion was set up with the knowledge and assistance of the U.S. Embassy, he said, but its mission went beyond the rooting out of Salvadoran and Nicaraguan agents suspected of running guns to the Salvadoran left. By 1984, more than 200 so-called subversives in Honduras, teachers, students, labor leaders, and opposition politicians, had been kidnapped and murdered. Zuniga claimed by elements working under the battalion. Zuniga charged that the CIA had had some knowledge of the killings and that the agency also had known the Hondurans were using Nicaraguan Contras to serve in the patrols. Zuniga made at least six trips to Capitol Hill. In informal meetings with congressional aides, he reported on the corruption within the Honduran military and the Contras and echoed the call of Contra leader Aiden Pastora, who said that former Somocistas like Ricardo Lau and Enrique Bermudez would have to be purged from the movement before the Contras could make headway in Nicaragua. Zuniga was racing against time, convinced that U.S. officials in Tegucigalpa and conservatives in the Honduran army wanted to silence him. Quote, he had what he regarded as reliable information that there was a concerted effort by U.S. intelligence agencies to force him out of the chain of command and completely out of the army, says Bruce Cameron. Indeed, after taking part in a Carnegie Endowment-sponsored peace conference on his last trip to Washington in May 1985, Zuniga was cashiered from the Army and for a brief time held under barracks detention. Quote, it's always difficult for people like Zuniga to know who to talk to in Washington, says a Senate staffer who met with him in 1985. And then, once they've talked, who to trust, unquote. Zuniga's efforts for reform did not go in vain. A barracks coup in 1984 removed General Alvarez from leadership, and the Honduran Army's own report on the 316 Battalion was eventually completed, supporting many of Zuniga's allegations. But his career was finished, and his life was in danger. Quote, he took the heat for all the others, says one Senate staffer, referring to the young officers who ousted Alvarez. In September of 1985, Zuniga's body was found in a shallow grave near the town of Danlí, close to an area surrounded by Contra camps and now called New Nicaragua by some Hondurans. A steel file driven into his chest was the murder weapon. According to the official Honduran report, Zuniga was killed by an exiled Cuban businessman who owed him money. Zuniga's death slowed the move for Contra reform in Honduras. Enrique Bermudez remained the head of the largest Contra army, and New Nicaragua is now more a fact of Honduran life than it was when Zuniga's body was found. His death also left many unanswered questions about the Contras and their U.S. supporters, questions that are sure to come before Congress and the independent prosecutor. Excuse me. Quote, he certainly would have been helpful on the matter of where the money went, says one congressional aide who met with Zuniga referring to the profits from the arms sales to Iran, money that Contra leaders say they never saw. Quote, He might have known about how cash was siphoned away from supplies and what price the Honduran military extracted for the use of its airfields in the resupply, adds a Senate aide. Quote, what did the Honduran army know about the mercenary groups and what kind of payoffs were made to local officials? All of these are areas he may have been able to shed more light on, unquote. Well, Zuniga probably knew a great deal more than that, and one of the things Zuniga might have been able to talk about at some length was, again, the 316 Battalion, yet another example of apparently a CIA-sponsored death squads dealing with the opposition, the political opposition, and as usual, peaceful political opposition, teachers, labor leaders, land reformers, etc., by sending out the military and mercenaries to essentially drag innocent civilians out and shoot them and dump them in ditches. This has been our foreign policy for a long time. The Reagan administration has once again revived it to a high art form. And Major Zuniga perhaps could have given some very serious information, naming names as to how early and how often the CIA was informed of the operations of the 316 Battalion.